Hello and welcome to this episode of Viewpoints. On this week's show, Quebec's expanding religious symbol ban sparks discussions about secularism.
Quebec has an ever-diverging view of what secularism means that increasingly is moving away from the standards that have been set by the Supreme Court of Canada and by human rights legislation in Canada.
To Nova Scotia, where a bookmobile delivers books, but also a sense of community along Liverpool's South Shore.
Hang in there.
I'm a year older today.
Are you in your birthday?
Crystal Hurt.
Well, congratulations. So what does that make you?
63.
No.
In New Brunswick, a local historian publishes a 1,000-page long book on the Canadian First World War cap badges.
My aim with this book is to connect people and their history with an artifact that they can hold and say, this was a piece of what my family was about.
In Cobourg, Ontario, the Night Stop program is looking for volunteers willing to share their homes with homeless youth. And one person can make a big difference in the lives of many others. Ole Dektyarov, Iron Man Run, is fueling a bigger fight for Ukraine.
Every time I wake up, I want to live. I'm like, man, I'm doing something for my country. I'm doing something for my people. I wake up with a purpose. Because at the end of the day, like when the war is over, you want to say, hey, I did something. Like when people ask, what did you do? I did this.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello to you all. Nice to have you with us. My name is Boris Chassin, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. A mobile library has been operating on Liverpool's South Shore since the 1970s, and it's the last one of its kind in Nova Scotia, still motoring through the region each week. The Bookmobile brings books, DVDs, and other materials to about 15 communities in Lunenburg and Queens counties, from Chester to Caledonia. And it keeps rolling even as other library systems around Nova Scotia have stopped their service. The Cape Breton Regional Library retired its Bookmobile in November 2024. So now the South Shore has the only remaining Bookmobile in the province, and it shows no signs of slowing down. Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
Hello.
Good day.
Hi.
Good day.
You're back.
3 weeks go by so fast.
Yeah,
okay.
Right?
You beat the rest of them here.
It's the last one in Nova Scotia, and it's still motoring along the South Shore. Each week, the Bookmobile brings books, DVDs, and other materials to about 15 communities in Lunenburg and Queens counties, from Chester to Caledonia. A mobile library has been operating on the South Shore since the 70s. Other library systems around Nova Scotia have stopped the service. The Cape Breton Regional Library retired its Bookmobile in November 2024. So now, the South Shore has the only remaining Bookmobile in the province, and it shows no signs of slowing down. Ashley Nunn-Smith is the CEO and Chief Librarian of South Shore Public Libraries.
Our Bookmobile has been on the road for 50 years, of course different vehicles throughout that time, but it's much beloved. It's very much a fabric of the community. When it is off the road, for example, a few weeks ago, we had someone bring the books out to Caledonia in their van because the Bookmobile was having some mechanical issues. And not only did people come to pick up their items, but they actually had almost like a tailgate party. They just hung around the back of the van and chatted with their neighbors. There was nothing keeping them there other than that sense of community. And so I think that's really what it's not just about the books, although that's wonderful to be able to drive books out to people when they live in more remote communities. It's really about the sense of community.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm all right.
Yeah. Hang in there.
I'm a year older today.
Are you in your birthday?
Crystal Hurt.
Well, congratulations. So what does that make you?
63.
No. Yeah. That can't be.
Joan Stevenson of Port Jolly was at a recent Bookmobile stop in Port Mattoon. Stevenson and her daughter Susie are some of the regular patrons the Bookmobile serves every 3 weeks at this location. It visits certain communities on a weekly basis, while others are on a tri-weekly schedule.
We remember when we had to fight to get a Bookmobile because the county didn't want it, although they were paying towards one, but they didn't want it. And instead they put street lights on our road and fought the Bookmobile. And we said it's a different kind of enlightenment.
On your birthday, I
made your cake. You had a birthday?
I do it today.
Hi,
please. How old are you, Terry?
Oh, six.
63, just a boy.
In 2021, the library put a new custom-built bookmobile on the road at a cost of about $500,000 with an accessibility lift, Wi-Fi, and 7 electrical outlets where people can charge their devices. Last year, the mobile service had an average of 1,100 monthly visitors who checked out about 3,000 items, accounting for about 15% of the library's overall visits and circulation. The cost of the bookmobile takes up about 2% of the library's overall $1.9 million operating budget. Nunn Smith says that because the South Shore has fewer physical library locations than other library systems around Nova Scotia, having the bookmobile is essential.
But by having the library on wheels, we can bring it to more spaces than we would be able to reach with brick and mortar locations. We're able to reach more communities that we wouldn't be able to otherwise. You know, we reach Port Matoun and we Mill Village and those places, it wouldn't be feasible to operate a library branch. And so we're able to bring the library to them.
Susie Stevenson says she remembers the anticipation as a kid waiting for the bookmobile to visit, a feeling she still has years later.
We all went and we'd come home with clothes baskets full of books, and the 8 of us would just sit around and read. And that's, you would get the books and you'd sit around and read, and you would do it until they were like, until you had to eat. It keeps me in reading material, and it keeps me, you know, interested and not depressed. That I can sit, I can read a book, I can look at it, and whether I read them or all or look at them, I'll take 2 or 3 bags lots of times.
Her mother, Joan, says it's something she looks forward to every 3 weeks.
I can't be away too long. My husband's disabled, so it's fun to come here. And the wonderful thing is that the people who drive and work on the bookmobile over all these years we've had it have always become our friends. They know what we're looking for, and we laugh, and they want to know how your trip was or how somebody's had a surgery was. It's they become friends. Nay, we love it. We love the bookmobile. I'm an old lady, and hopefully it will outlive me.
Seeing you again? Yes. We'll look forward to doing it 3 weeks from today. Awesome. Thank you. See you, girls, ladies.
We'll see you. Happy birthday.
Yes, thank you. We're going to get together.
You can find the schedule for the bookmobile on the South Shore Public Library's website.
I got your beer cold.
Oh, right on.
I know.
That's an invite. I'll bring my cold beer.
All right. You bring your cold beer.
All righty. See ya.
See ya.
I'm Rick Conrad.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Abakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
We'll make our next stop in Winnipeg, running alongside Ole Dekcharov, who's going to do a full Ironman triathlon to raise funds for Ukraine. Ole Dekcharov is now training for the event 6 days a week, often waking up at 5 a.m., this to raise $100,000 for the armed forces of Ukraine. Through his initiative, Iron Hearts for Ukraine, athletes can register as ambassadors working towards their goals while raising funds together. Dekcharov says the past few months have been difficult to witness. He recalls watching the news when President Zelensky came to see Trump in the Oval Office and how upsetting the conversation was. Despite support from the U.S. hanging by a thread, Dekcharov says he is not deterred. In fact, he's more motivated than ever. Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Muscles aching and lungs burning, Ole Dekcharov pushes himself through his workouts. He does this 6 days a week, often waking up at 5 a.m. to train.
Every time I wake up and I know that I'm doing this with my team, I want to live. I'm like, man, I'm doing something for my country. I'm doing something for my people. I wake up with a purpose.
Ole's goal is to complete a full Ironman triathlon. But more importantly for him, to raise $100,000 for the armed forces of Ukraine.
Because at the end of the day, like when the war is over, you want to say, hey, I did some. Like when people ask, what did you do? I did this. And I did this because we had this great idea and we pulled it off.
With family moving to Canada 14 years ago, and himself moving to Canada 8 years ago, Ole has spent the past few years actively supporting his home country. Now he'll do that through a new initiative, Iron Hearts for Ukraine.
Kind of last year, I was competing in triathlon. So I got into triathlon. My dream was to complete a full Ironman. So it's a 4K swim, 180K bike, and a full marathon to run. And last year, I completed half Ironman, which was fun. And right after that, I was like, well, why don't I just start raising money for Ukrainian Armed Forces as I'm training for the full Ironman for next year?
Ole says the past few months have been difficult to witness, with the United States pulling support for Ukraine feeling like a betrayal. He recalls watching the news when President Zelensky came to see Trump in the Oval Office.
That whole scene that unfolded there, right? It was painful to watch because, like, there's a guy coming and asking for help. And I don't want to say bullying, but there's, like, a lot of disrespect to him.
He continues.
Their support was, like, probably 60-70% of the whole packages of support, right? That's big. That's big. And the fact that they're trying to push now is Zelensky to kind of settle for it's not supposed to be a discussion.
Despite support from the U.S. hanging by a thread, Ole says he is not deterred. In fact, he says he's more motivated than ever. However, raising $100,000 is difficult to do alone. So Ole and his team created Iron Hearts for Ukraine,
where we can kind of bring athletes around Canada together, Ukrainians, Canadians, anybody who is interested to support Ukraine. We're going to give them the opportunity to raise money, train for their events. We're going to bring the community together. We're going to create some maybe group chats on WhatsApp, motivate people. It's going to be great. So let's do that.
When asked why he set the goal at $100,000, Ole laughs.
It's a challenge. $100,000 sounds big, but at the end of the day, my family has friends that serve. And when you ask them how much money, like, does it go every single day? Like those drones that people donate their money on, like $2,000, it's up in the air, 2 seconds later, it's gone. So $2,000 goes to waste within like 10 minutes, just so I understand. So like having collected $100,000, in reality, it's not really a big amount, but for us, it sounds like a challenge.
The Iron Hearts for Ukraine initiative is already gaining traction. Ole's mother is training for a marathon, and several close friends have signed up as ambassadors. He says most ambassadors are Ukrainian or of Ukrainian descent, and understands that the ongoing conflict feels distant for many Canadians. However, he believes that might change with the continued threats of making Canada the 51st state.
Possibly, I think so, especially with everything that Trump is saying right now. You know, it's for Canada, it's threats pretty much, right? But everything he does towards Europe and towards Ukraine right now, I really hope is going to stimulate people to be like, hey, I got to take action. Like, I got to do something myself.
Ole says he is confident they'll reach their goal and maybe even exceed it. However, he says, most of all, he hopes that people are inspired to make a difference, whether it's through his initiative or another.
The more people support an initiative like that, the faster we're going to raise the money and the more help we're going to get. And, you know, as one of our teammates on this team is saying, it's like, you know, I really hope we're going to save at least one life. If we're going to save at least one life, that's great.
Okay.
That's what it's all about, yeah?
I'm Ryan Funk.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
To the province of Quebec now, where the Legault government is creating quite a stir with a new bill banning religious symbols. He wants to expand the ban further into the education system. If adopted, as most analysts say it will, Bill 94 could prevent every employee and volunteer involved in the education system from wearing religious symbols. Under the current rules set by Bill 21, teachers and public-facing civic employees cannot wear religious symbols. Adam Innes spoke with the legal expert Pearl Eliadis and board member of the Canadian Council of Muslim Women, Shaheen Ashraf, about Quebec's secularism trends. Adam Innes in Montreal, Quebec.
Under the current rules set by Bill 21, teachers and public-facing civic employees cannot wear religious symbols such as turbans, hijabs, kippahs, or other religious symbols. This new bill, tabled earlier in March, Bill 94, which is expected to pass, will extend that ban beyond just public-facing employees. Janitors, school administrators, and even volunteers would not be able to work in religious symbols. Students would also not be able to wear face coverings. Pearl Eliadis is a legal scholar and practicing lawyer who specializes in democratic governance. Eliadis says this is part of Quebec's trend towards a more intrusive definition of secularism.
Quebec has an ever-diverging view of what secularism means that increasingly is moving away from the standards that have been set by the Supreme Court of Canada and by human rights legislation in Canada.
Eliadis believes this new expansion is dragging the discussion around secularism in an unreasonable direction.
Public-facing officials who wield authority over people, I think reasonable people can differ about whether or not it's appropriate to restrict their religious rights because they're facing the public. People might be concerned, for example, of a policeman or policewoman, you know, with a certain religious symbol. I personally don't share that view, but at least I understand it. I don't think it's right, but I understand it. But this change, you know, I think shows that the divergence is moving even further away, because now we're talking about people who aren't even necessarily public facing.
Shaheen Ashraf is a board member of the Canadian Council of Muslim Women, a group that has been advocating for the rights of Muslim women in Canada since 1982.
We actually advocate, you know, for the Muslim woman's right to wear whatever she is comfortable in.
Ashraf believes these rules are designed to aggravate Muslims in the province. The banning of symbols for volunteers, she finds especially extreme.
It's terrible. It's terrible. I mean, I have contributed to society by the grace of God in a good way all the time, and I cover my head, and nobody has a problem with that, you know? Except the government just creating rules for nothing. I mean, they create problems for things that don't exist or matter. You know? I mean, define secularism to me. What is secularism according to your belief? To me, today in Quebec, the secularism is like another religion that is being forced down our throats.
The province would not respond directly to Eliadis's and Ashraf's comments, but pointed CJLO to a media statement from Quebec Education Minister Bernard Drenville, who wrote, quote, "In Quebec, we made the decision that state and religion are separate. We say the public schools are separate from religion," unquote. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
You're tuned to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
In Ontario, the Rebound Child and Youth Services are seeking to decrease youth homelessness in Northumberland County by asking for volunteers who are willing to share their home for a night. The new program called Night Stop will begin next month. Night Stop was first started in the United Kingdom in the 1980s. Night Stop will be looking for community volunteers willing to offer a room in their home for the youth to spend the night. An extensive vetting process of both the youth and the homeowner ensures that all involved are provided with safe and supportive opportunities. Dan Jones in Cobourg, Ontario.
A new youth homelessness program is being launched in Northumberland County. Night Stop, which is set to begin in May, aims to place youth aged 16 to 24 in vetted homes in the community, either for a single night or an extended stay. A host home is generally a volunteer community member who has undergone extensive training, ensuring youth accessing their home are provided safe and supportive housing. Rebound Child and Youth Services is offering the program. Executive Director Sam Rockbrun told a Northumberland County Social Services Committee meeting Wednesday that Night Stop is designed to provide temporary housing.
Night Stop is an alternative housing solution for youth experiencing homelessness by enlisting community members to volunteer their homes as temporary shelters for youth in need. Currently, Northumberland County does not have a youth shelter, which makes Night Stop the first resource for youth in crisis in the community, and it's essential for addressing this critical gap for youth homelessness.
The program was founded in the United Kingdom in 1987, eventually taking roots in Canada in 2018. As part of the process, Rebound will conduct risk assessments on the youth, including two reference checks. The host home will offer a private room to sleep, an evening and breakfast meal, and a to-go lunch. Shower and laundry facilities are also accessible. Nightstop staff will ensure a smooth transfer for the youth at night and be available for the duration of the stay. Youth must abstain from substance use and follow host rules. Rockburn says finding stable housing for youth is the ultimate goal.
Nightstop really is a way to fill a gap, so that way youth are not sleeping rough on the streets or are not sleeping somewhere unsafe. In terms of some alternative options, it's kind of a unique case by case. Quite often it is family reunification or natural supports. So maybe you are able to put them, again, in with an aunt or an uncle that they weren't previously living with, especially if they're able to get onto the trusteeship program at the same time.
Youth can access Nightstop for up to 6 weeks. I'm Dan Jones.
Candace Vetter in Embrim, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
And we close our show in Fredericton this week, where local historian and former president of the York Sunbury Historical Society, Harold Hal Scarrap, began distributing his latest book. Harold chose a long title for his 1,000-page-long book, Canadian Expeditionary Force and Military Cap Badges, York Sunbury Historical Society, Fredericton Region Museum Collection. Mr. Scarrap was on a mission to catalog every badge worn by the Canadian military on their hats during the First World War, the majority of which were photographed from the Fredericton Region Museum's collection. Scarrap hopes that his book will serve as a resource for museums, archives, and enthusiasts to better understand and connect with the past. Journalist Aidan Keenan in Fredericton met up with Hal Scarrap to talk about the significance of cap badges and why he thought it was so important to create this book.
In March of 2025, Fredericton-based historian Hal Scarrap began distributing his newest book, called Canadian Expeditionary Force and Militia Cap Badges, York Sunbury Historical Society, Fredericton Region Museum Collection. Coming in at a little over 1,000 pages, this book catalogs all the cap badges used by the Canadian military during the First World War. Each entry is accompanied by a color photograph of the badge itself, almost all of which are held in the Fredericton Region Museum's collection. Being admittedly a niche topic, Hal explained who his intended audience is.
These are reference material books. My hope is that the museums will make use of these books, and this one specifically on the badges. It's one of two. I mean, it was such a big project, just the First World War. And it's 1,000 pages that I had to break it up into First War and Second World War. If you were at a museum in Manitoba or Nova Scotia or Newfoundland or wherever, and you're looking up First World War badges, this book, A, has a photograph of the cap badge. Two, if you want to know something about the unit's history, I've gone into the Library and Archives Canada files for the official war records, and I've taken their 2 to 3 paragraph summary of the history of that unit. When it was formed, where it was formed, how it was formed, and sent overseas. Was it disbanded or did it fight? Who was famous? Who won the Victoria Cross, for example? And then it's indexed so that a researcher from anywhere can find it.
Hal elaborated on what makes cap badges specifically so significant.
If you get into the world of badge collecting, you have to realize that that's only part of your uniform. Even today, you wear a cap badge. On your shoulder, you wear a flash that tells you which unit you're with. The badges change with the kings and the queens. For example, we've just gone from the queen's crown for Queen Elizabeth to the king's crown for King Charles III. New badges are required to carry that out. My thought was that other collectors have put together all of the minutiae, the collar dogs and the shoulder flashes. You're getting down into the weeds there and serious money and serious difficulties cataloging everything. But the badge is extremely important to the person wearing it. A lot of people during the Second World War, when they're brought in, were loaned to a unit. Okay, I don't have a vacancy for you at the moment, but if you want to get fed, I got to attach you to the South Saskatchewan Regiment. I know you're from New Brunswick, and we'll get you with a New Brunswick unit. But you're with the SSRs for the next 3 days, so you get fed and paid. Okay, now we're officially assigning you to the Cape Breton Highlanders. So people actually have backgrounds where they might have worn several different badges, but the one that's most important to them is the one that they served with the most.
Beyond simple military identification, Hal noted that there's often a deep sentiment attached to physical pieces of history like cap badges, especially after those who wore them are no longer with us.
When my grandfather passed, my aunt, she said, I think you'd like to have these. And she gave me my grandfather's spurs from 1915. And I hold these things today and I said, this was my grandfather's. He was there. This is the real McCoy. This isn't something I got from somebody else at a flea market. This was his. And it bites. It hits. And if it has that effect on me, I suspect that other people, when they take a cap badge that would have been worn by their family member in 1917, it's going to have the same effect.
Hal emphasized that connecting people to that history was his ultimate goal when writing this book.
What can we put together that will be useful to a person who comes in off the street and says, my grandfather says that I read that he served in the 126th Battalion. Do you have anything that belonged to him? You can go to this book and you look up the name of the battalion in the index. The index will take you to page 93, and here's a photograph of that badge. Now, the person working in the museum today opens the book to the page on the badge and looks down, and it has the accession number. You take this individual, and you go upstairs, and you open that drawer, and here is the real badge, one like your grandfather might have worn in the First World War, and you put it in that person's hand, and suddenly it's not a picture in a book. It's the real artifact. So it's my aim with this book is to connect people and their history with an artifact that they can hold and say, this was a piece of what my family was about. That's the aim of the book.
Hal finished by describing some of the more interesting badges he came across while writing.
There are badges dedicated to the Viking community of Canada. And so, of course, the badge has the Viking ship with a Norseman. There are peculiar badges that are a devil with a pitchfork. About 7 or 8 different ones. Why? I don't know. The little red devils, whatever it is. There are badges, one from British Columbia, with 2 lions on it. And how did that come about? There are badges that have very little more than the number on them, which is kind of odd. And then there are some that are so darn elaborate, it's really difficult to figure out. We also have badges that soldiers traded to other countries. So we have badges from New Zealand and Australia, for example. There are badges from way back in the day that would surprise you by the names of them. A very large number of Acadian badges that have traditions that go back from before the British occupation here. And in fact, the museum has a number of badges that no one else has. And when I was going to other collectors asking for photographs of a few that we don't have, they came back and said, do you have a picture of the 187th? And I said, yes, because we have one. He said, nobody else has got one.
I'm Aidan Keenan, Local Journalism Initiative.
And that's it for us. A big thank you to our journalists this week, Rick Conrad, Adam Innes, Ryan Funk, Dan Jones, and Aidan Keenan. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.
Radio@frequencynews.ca.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Tech and Talk. This week, we're joined by Joe Borsato, a final year PhD candidate in the Department of History at Queen's. He is an expert in Indigenous law and Indigenous history, and empire. And he's here today to speak about his experience in history, his research, and much more. Professor Borsato, Joe Borsato, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much, Sam.
Super. So just before we started recording, we asked you about how you became a PhD candidate. And I was wondering if you could just explain that again for the greater audience, because it's sort of a rare thing. I was reading this statistic earlier. Only about 8% of people who do an undergrad in history go on to a master's. And then of that, a very few percent go on to get a PhD. So if you wouldn't mind just describing it in general, that'd be great.
Sure. It's been a sort of weird meandering journey. Always kind of is, I think. So I started off in undergrad at the University of Calgary. I'm originally from British Columbia. I'm from sort of central British Columbia. It's the territory of the Tsleil-Waututh people, the Tsleil-Waututh people, Deketh people. But I didn't want to live like in the Lower Mainland for university, because it's even that long ago, it was expensive, too expensive. So I went to Calgary, I started off in a lot of like STEM fields. I did chemistry, biology, physics, all that sort of fun stuff. And it was sort of like unquestionably my sort of best scores and grades and stuff were in those fields. And everyone was encouraging me to go into those fields. That's sort of what I was going to do. But at a certain point, I took some history and classics courses. And, you know, I thought that was just a sort of different intellectual enterprise. So, you know, we'd read things like different accounts of the Roman Empire, like Cassius Dio and Tacitus. And you're like, well, which one of these is correct? They're writing about the same thing around roughly the same time. So, like, one of them has to be right and one of them has to be wrong, right? You'd ask this to the professor and the professor would be like, well, what do you think? And, you know, and why? And it's like, oh, these are very different kinds of questions. And, you know, very big questions that people, you know, are still asking. And so I was like, okay, so I have to do this, right? Like, even no matter what happens afterwards, after undergrad, I have to do this while I'm here. So I ended up, I ended up doing some research assistant work for one professor who took me under his wing, which involved going to Europe at one point to do research in the National Archives of the United Kingdom, which was really fascinating. You get to like flip through like old archival documents from the 16th century, which is really fun. And, you know, it's the sort of thing that it just brought me a lot of satisfaction. So anyway, really enjoyed that. Ended up doing a master's. Excuse me. Ended up doing a master's at the University of Alberta, just up the road, and for a year there. And then for like financial reasons, I took a couple of years off to work. I worked in the nonprofit sector. I worked in a museum. I worked in a sustainability organization. I enjoyed the last one quite a bit, but I was very sort of dissatisfied with the public history museum sort of sector for a number of reasons. It just didn't bring me the same kind of satisfaction as I got from doing research. And then also, I had something I really wanted to say to the research that I just didn't feel was being said in the historiography, in the scholarship on the history of Indigenous peoples and empires. And that was a big sort of driving force for me. So after a couple of years in nonprofits, I applied for a lot of different PhD programs, and Queen's ended up being the best fit for me for a variety of reasons. And I've been here for the last 4 and a bit years, which has been great. I've been able to do a lot of that research. I've published a couple peer-reviewed articles and that sort of fun stuff. So yeah, it's been, there's a lot more I still want to do on that, but yeah, so that's sort of what got me here. And the other thing I guess I should add that drove me to do this is when I didn't do very much teaching in undergrad and in the master's, but when I was in nonprofits, I did a lot of leadership stuff. I ran a nonprofit for a while, which was a whole other experience. But the part about that I enjoyed was working with people and being in a sort of leadership position, directing the nonprofit's projects and helping, you know, people overcome their own obstacles in their work. And so I thought, well, this is kind of like teaching. Mm-hmm. So that was the other sort of thing where I was like, I want to get more experience in that. And I want to do that more. And so that was another sort of motivating factor as well.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And for those of you who don't know, it's not very common to publish two peer-reviewed articles, even more than that as well. And while you're a doctoral student, which, so quite frankly, that's remarkable if that gives you any idea of how academically inclined Joel Versado is. But on a separate note, I was going to ask, though, did a lot of the things that you learned and the skills you developed in working in the nonprofit sector translate to writing a thesis?
Well, first of all, that's flattering. Thank you very much. There's a third one on the way. It should be out later this year. A third article. I'd say writing itself, like writing a dissertation, it's not so much about, I mean, it is a lot about how many words you can get on a page, but it's also so much about planning and so much about how much you can anticipate work ahead of time and plan for it and allocate your hours so you don't like get overworked or get overwhelmed and get burned out. I would say that aspect of working in nonprofits, especially nonprofits, like you get this experience from working in any kind of private sector or even public sector work, but working in nonprofits, which is very sort of on the small scale nonprofits, and this was a small nonprofit, a couple small nonprofits, there's so much planning that you have to do, you know, in terms of doing budgets, in terms of doing team building with staff. I worked with a lot of summer students, for instance, in museums and in sustainability organizations. And so there was a lot of like hands-on interpersonal time that you had to plan for, and there's a lot of stuff you couldn't plan for, and you had to plan for that too, which is kind of funny. Right. Never book yourself for more than like 75% of your time. So a lot of stuff like that was very helpful when it came to doing a PhD, because doing a PhD is very much just being put in the sea and being told you now have to sail it. And it's like, oh, okay. I'll try my best, I guess. Right. But having some sort of like knowledge of like, well, okay, how long did it take me to write a chapter? Okay, well then how much, you know, how do I scale that, right, mm-hmm. to a whole dissertation? You know, being able to sort of think that through and plan ahead, I think, is like really important and has definitely saved me a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, surely. I can only imagine. I mean, I'm writing an undergraduate thesis now, which is significantly less, and even that requires a decent bit of planning.
Yeah, that's hard because it's the first time you've ever done something like that, right? When I when I wrote my undergraduate thesis, that was like, oh my goodness. Like, you know, I didn't have like the closest thing, obviously, which, you know, experience is writing an essay in a like for a term paper or something, right? Which isn't the same size or the necessarily the same amount of like thought has to be put into it, right? Mm-hmm. More thought has to be put into a dissertation. So yeah, no, it's harder the first time you do something, right? Mm-hmm. Once you, like when I did my master's thesis, that was a lot like less painful process. Right. So yeah, so good for you for doing that, though.
Thank you.
That's really good experience.
Yeah, and on the topic of thesis, I've just generally, yours is about Anglo-Indigenous relations, specifically as it relates to the American continent. So I guess it's almost like an Atlantic, you know, perspective as well. Mm-hmm. Would you like to just speak about that a little bit in particular?
Sure. It's the sort of thing where not many historians look at the history of Anglo-Indigenous relations in an oceanic context, in the context of like the hemisphere or of the Atlantic Ocean. So, you know, a lot of historians will just study the history of Virginia, you know, the history of New England, the colonies there, when it relations with Powhatan or Wampanoag peoples. And so I was very dissatisfied with that, partly because it's just been done so much. So I was struggling to find anything new to say about that. I also just sort of have other interests besides that. My dissertation examines Anglo-Indigenous relations in the late 16th and early 17th centuries in place in northern South America, so what, you know, the English call Guiana, or what the Arawak people, the Locono people there, call Gurinoco, which just means the land of many waters, because there's a lot of rivers there. But also the Caribbean, which is very underrated as a region to study. I do talk a little bit about Virginia and New England, but also Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, and the Hudson Bay. So this is a sort of very kind of big project, but it's also sort of bound by a very specific time period. And what I've sort of been trying to argue in the dissertation is that Indigenous peoples challenged the English Empire really from the outset in both material terms, so in terms of like warfare and that sort of stuff, but also in emotional terms. And so this is something that's often not discussed and that I felt I really had to say about the work, about this research, is that Indigenous peoples made very overt expressions of their own political societies, in the sense that they were civil societies and could govern themselves and possess territory. And these expressions really created an atmosphere of insecurity in the early English Empire. And I find this in various forms in all of the contexts that I look at. And so this is sort of my intervention in the field. If you want me to get down into a specific example, you know, there's an incident in Virginia, for instance, where in 1609, just 2 years after the Jamestown settlement was established, the first permanent English settlement in the Americas, where the Virginia Company, which was the joint stock corporation that was chartered for colonizing in Virginia, they wrote a memorandum in 1609, shortly after making being engaged with the Powhatan polity, which is the large sort of paramount chiefdom, as it's sometimes called in the region, sort of loose alignment of Algonquin speaking peoples. And anyway, the Virginia Company says in this memorandum that they must abstain from making a claim to the land in the Chesapeake, in the Chesapeake Bay area in Virginia. And they explicitly say on account of what they call the naturals, on account of Indigenous peoples, on account of the Powhatans. And so this to me is a really sort of telling memorandum, because it says like they don't have the kind of language, they don't have the capacity to make a claim on this territory, which I think is a really remarkable thing when you think about what comes later, which is just, you know, four centuries of European empires sort of unabashedly claiming Indigenous territory. And so there was something going on here, right, where the Powhatan expressions, and I track a lot of these in the archives and printed sources, expressions of their power, expressions of their possession of territory. And so this is, you know, I think in many ways this memorandum is a response to the Powhatans. And I think this is an important moment where Indigenous peoples are expressing their rights, their abilities to be regarded among the community of nations. And I think this is a, you know, it's just a really important moment. Now, this is sort of thing where things change. Eventually, the sort of the English develop a certain amount of confidence in engaging with Indigenous peoples after several years of having settlements in the Americas. So this does change, but I think it's still an important context that informs the events of early English colonization.
That's super fascinating. And you said, though, that in general as well, like the emotional element, people don't really study in history. Is there a particular reason for that? Is it because it's just harder to decipher through the archives? Or is it because they just saw it as something that wasn't of significance until recently when we started adding more dimensions to the historical scope?
That's an interesting question. I think there are a number of reasons, one of which is probably to a certain extent historical training, like in the way that everything in history departments everywhere, in as far as I know them anyway, is everyone works in a field. You know, someone does Canadian history, another person does American history, another person does, you know, Latin American or South American history. And that, you know, people don't talk to each other. They don't go to each other's conferences. They don't read each other's work. So to an extent, I think everyone's kind of siloed off. And I also think that like people who study more sort of like material history of what Indigenous people did in the past versus the sort of more emotional history, I think those are very separate fields as well. There hasn't really... I think just people just don't put these things together by virtue of just how the academy is organized. Unfortunately, I think. I'm going to have to think about that a little bit more, as I think there's probably more to it than that. Mm-hmm. But that's my sort of initial response.
I wasn't actually expecting that, but it does make sense though, because the more I think about it, it is kind of rare to see professors go cross departmental in their readings and research. Through different fields.
Yeah, I think that applies to other things too. Science and everything's also got the same problems for sure.
Absolutely. Like even fields that you would think would be in conversation with each other. It just doesn't happen. It's bizarre and I don't think good for knowledge.
And if you don't mind, maybe we could just speak about your two articles that are currently published.
Sure.
And so the first one I have in front of me right now is the one that you published in Global Intellectual History, Contra Eis Gentium, the Mendoza-Drake Dispute and English Legal Arguments for Empire in 1580 to 1585. So this, if I'm not mistaken, that was part of your undergraduate thesis in Calgary. It touched on the topic. Like, is this the same article as it was when you wrote the thesis, or is it more expanded now?
It's definitely more expanded now. My honors thesis was not that polished.
This is probably the best honors thesis I've ever read.
That's very generous of you to say. My honors thesis was a lot rougher than this. A lot rougher than this. But yes, it's the same research that informs it. So this is based on some of that, like that first sort of archival experience I got. I went to the UK. So this is many years ago when I did the research. It was a lot of work for me as an undergrad, and I sort of really wanted, when I was in the PhD, to sort of, okay, I really want to justify all that work I did. Mm-hmm. And I think anyone really who writes an honors thesis should consider, doing this, in consultation with your professors, obviously. But, I think I really wanted to put it out there just to sort of justify all that time and effort. And it really wasn't a ton of time and effort in order to clean it up, make it more presentable. And the peer review process is a lot of work, but it still wasn't like an immense amount more work than just writing the original piece. So, the bulk of the work had been done. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to get this out there. I mean, it's a bit of an odd piece, I guess, in a way, because it's trying to chart a very particular aspect of empire in the context of early English engagement with especially the Taino people in the Caribbean and various indigenous nations on the west coast of mm-hmm. North America. So it's a very sort of it's charting a change in imperial discourse that occurs in the 1580s amidst Francis Drake, this gallivanting pirate who goes around the world. This is the second recorded circumnavigation of the world. And from this event, Spain and England get into an argument about, him claiming territory in the Americas for England. And it's this really sort of moment where the English crown steps in and really tries to argue for its own claims vis-a-vis the Spanish. And there's a whole bunch of interesting things that come up in that debate. Number of, the English use arguments that the sea is open for everyone to trade in and to go places and claim land that, is supposedly not held by anyone. So it's an interesting sort of moment of that sort of whole discourse, and there's more that could be said about that, but I won't sort of belabor the point. But it's an interesting little episode, I guess.
Oh, it is super fascinating. And I think one of the things I took away from the article itself is that within the debate itself, the notion of Eis Gentium terms sort of became an acceptable argument to be made in a European expansionist context. Is that like roughly fair. I guess.
Very fair.
Yeah, that's
very good. A very, very good way of putting it. I've always sort of, you know, there's this angle of on international law, really, mm-hmm. is what the Jus Gentium is. It's this, you know, this precursor to the law of nations is really what it was called at the time. It's the precursor sort of to international law and there are a few other incidents before this where there are debates about having the right to trade off the coast of Africa. The English have arguments with the Portuguese about this in the 16th century, in the 1560s, I believe. So this isn't necessarily the first incident where these debates come up, but it is one where I think the rhetoric gets really hyped up. So, yeah. And it informs a lot of at the very end of the article, I talk a little bit about Richard Hakluyt, mm-hmm. or Hakluyt, as his name is probably supposed to be pronounced, who draws on Drake's experience to inform a lot of the rhetoric around colonization. So, yeah, I'm trying to track a lot of these discussions because, I mean, there's a lot of discourse today, for instance, about what role international law has in, some countries interfering in other countries' affairs, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's sort of one of the things that drew me to doing that research originally was like, well, how does this inform empire? Mm-hmm. How does international law inform empires very early on? So, yeah, and I've always sort of had a penchant for studying people like Francisco de Vitoria, who's a Jus Gentium theorist, and Alberico Gentili, who's another Jus Gentium theorist, and they come up a lot in this whole thing. So, yeah, it's something I find interesting, and it's not really part of like my PhD research per se, but it is something that I was interested in undergrad and have sort of informed some of what I've been doing since then. So,
yeah. It seems super interesting. It just occurred to me that you must also know a decent bit of Latin as well. Through reading through all these documents.
I have spent like 500 hours learning Latin or something like that. Yeah, it's a
tough language.
Well, yeah,
a little bit.
You had a great Latin teacher in high school.
Well, yeah, I mean, reading Latin is one thing, but to speak it is definitely
pretty difficult. Pretend to speak it in any meaningful way.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work. Yeah.
In your article, I noticed that you referenced a couple times that they were using like Roman like laws and stuff. I thought that was interesting because they're still going digging all the way back to trying to, you know, still find justification. And, you know, they were, you know, using the Roman Empire as an example, I guess.
Oh, yeah. The classical tradition is really important. So important. Can't be understated. Even like I know it's sort of this like it's the 16th century. So it's like the late Renaissance kind of thing. So there's obviously a lot of like, you know, pulling on the old Roman and Greek tradition, but I think the classical tradition doesn't really ever go away. So yeah. I think it's one of these things I think it's really important. Very good of you to have a Latin teacher in high school.
It's
very rare. Yeah. but good for you. That's awesome.
Yeah. And if we may, just for the sake of time as well, talk a bit about the other article. This one, I assume, comes out of your doctoral research, just based off what I read and you were telling, and based off what you're telling us about your research. But this in the Journal of History, we should sow and reap in peace Algonquin foundations of colonial insecurity in the correspondence of the Virginia Company. And in this one, it's like I'm assuming it's sort of like an abstract of part of your thesis, if I understood correctly from when you were explaining your thesis.
Yeah, so it's adjacent to the thesis. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not like a chapter or anything, but it's adjacent to the thesis research. It's some stuff that just couldn't fit into the dissertation. So I'm flattered that you both read my articles. I have to say
they're really interesting.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. This is adjacent to the dissertation. So this kind of came out of a special issue of the Journal of History. They wanted to do a piece on genocide in the past. I don't know, maybe there's something wrong with me, but like when someone first sort of told me about this, I was like, oh, well, it'd be really cool to have, you know, someone who writes about like the history of destruction and how, the destruction of nations and how that informs, like how that was informed by the history of empire, how empire informs writing about destruction and violence. I sort of discovered, you know, after I actually submitted to this and, you know, we went through the peer review process and it eventually got published, that I was the only person in the special issue who wrote about anything other than like the 20th century or late 19th century. So I was like, oh, well, I'm kind of glad I actually submitted for that in a way. So I didn't necessarily take this article from the perspective of like, how was early English colonization genocide, which I think is a fairly straightforward question to ask. I wanted to ask it more in the sense of, well, how did indigenous people's actions shape contemporary, like 17th century discourses about empire and the destruction of nations? So I kind of flipped it a little bit in a way that I don't necessarily know a lot of people would. But so I did that. And, you know, I was really interested in looking at how various Algonquin peoples, mostly the Powhatans in Virginia, but number of other nations in that region, what they did in order to challenge the English, especially like in the emotional terms, right? So there are a couple case studies in there. There's, you know, from the title of it, there's one Powhatan messenger who goes to the English very early on within the first couple months of the colony. And, you know, it's not clear if he ever says this explicitly, but the record indicates that they agreed, they being the Powhatan messenger and the Virginia Company colonists, agreed that they should sow and reap in peace, so that they should, you know, they should accept one another's presence and that they should just continue to, you know, harvest crops together. Mm-hmm. So this is a sort of, you know, indication of the Powhatans, you know, if you look at it from their perspective, we're really trying to bring stability to these newcomers who just showed up. Like, this is our territory. We will sow and reap in peace together, right? This is a sort of very overt effort on their part to bring the English into their fold. There's a couple other incidents when the English do eventually break with this promise a few years later, that one messenger, Okanidge, he's not Powhatan, but he's from another Algonquin nation. He comes to them and brings a message and says, you know, like, if you try and dispossess us, we'll just move. And he has this whole speech in there that I thought was really interesting. So I, you know, I track that and I look at the, how that changes the sort of dynamic at play. And so the sort of the, and there's a few other examples like that throughout the piece, but it's sort of really trying to get at that, the insecurities at play in early colonization and how that then informs broader writings about destruction of nations and then ultimately genocide with Raphael Lemkin, who coined the term.
Interesting. And what would you say was the biggest factor that led to the dissolution of English insecurity as it comes to indigenous Anglo relations?
So that's also a very good question. Probably the most important thing would be just the passage of time. So the experience of having colonies that don't just fail within a year or two, mm-hmm. for the English Empire, because a lot of they did try to colonize many times.
Well, the most predominant one I can think of is we read about last year when I was in your class, but Roanoke, yeah. For one, sticks out quite a bit.
Exactly. Yeah. So Roanoke is perfect example of a failed colony in the 16th century. There were many more in the early 17th century. Even there was one that was contemporary to the Virginia Company. It was even called the Virginia Company of Plymouth, not the Virginia Company of London. But they tried to establish a colony in northern, what is now northern Maine, in Abenaki territory, and that lasted a year, right? And established at virtually the same time as the Virginia Company that actually, like, went.
Saturday mornings. Whether you're waking up in a stranger's apartment or enjoying some time with the family, you need a nutritional breakfast for your ears. So join me, DJ Overeasy, for Making Bacon every Saturday morning from 8 until 10 on CFRC 101.9 and CFRC.ca.